From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The U.S. economy added 130,000 new jobs last month, and the Labor Department said today that the unemployment rate remained steady in August at 3.7%. But economists do have a warning. Job growth is slowing down as President Trump's trade war with China drags on.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Chad Pergram, senior Capitol Hill producer for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Gentlemen.
And Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Tolu.
Good afternoon.
Okay, so before the jobs numbers came out, President Trump tweeted more criticism of the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, for not cutting interest rates as much as Trump wants to stimulate the economy. He wrote, "Where did I find this guy, Jerome?" Because, of course, Trump appointed him. "Oh, well, you can't win them all." That's from the president's tweet. Chad, what is the president's strategy as concerns grow about the economy and a possible recession?
That it's not his fault if there is a slowdown, if there is a recession, those sorts of things. You know, a lot of people think that the 2020 election is going to be about the economy. When it comes to President Trump's support, if things are going very well, this is something that he has propounded for a long time here, then he thinks he's going to be in pretty good shape, you know, and that could add to his base and get some of those swing voters who are benefiting from an economic prosperity. But if not, that's a problem. You know, I spoke with Mike Crapo, who is the chair of the Senate Banking Committee. He's a Republican senator from Idaho. If there's a question of independence in the Fed, this was a couple of weeks ago before the recess, and he said, "I have no qualms there." But some start to wonder that when the president is always criticizing Jerome Powell.
Tolu, how hard is re-election going to be for the president if the economy goes into recession?
Well, you have to remember the president's poll numbers remain underwater, and one of the things that are keeping them even where they are in the low 40s in most polls is the fact that most people give him high marks on the economy. They think the economy is doing relatively well. But if the economy does start to slow down, and if we do start to see those numbers turn, that could be a very major challenge and a hurdle for the president in terms of his reelection, in part because people aren't buying the idea that the Fed is to blame. They believe that the president is the one who is at the helm of the economy. They know that he's taken a lot of major actions when it comes to this trade war with China, increasing the debt, being sort of irrational and moving back and forth when it comes to various policy ideas. Those types of things are things that people link to the slowing economy. And if the economy slows down further, there's a chance that the president will be blamed for that, and that could harm his reelection chances.
Well, and Chad, look what happened this week to the stock market when the president said that the United States and China would now resume trade talks next month. It jumped 350 points. Is this part of his plan to just sort of feed the public headlines like this, these optimistic headlines, to keep optimism up?
Well, and you could also see a scenario when Congress returns to session next week that they start talking about the USMCA, the trade agreement between Mexico and Canada, and they are far behind on trying to get this worked out on Capitol Hill. And people start to, you know, comment on that, or there start to be leaks about, you know, just how badly it's going. And you could see that putting a dent in the stock market. So you're going to be on this roller coaster for a while, probably. That's the volatility. And the president hopes that there's more up days than down days. And, you know, that could be a problem if they're not getting anywhere with the USMCA.
Tolu, according to your reporting today, it was President Trump who drew that line on the weather map this week with a Sharpie to try and bolster a claim that Alabama was in the path of Hurricane Dorian, even though forecasters said that was not the case. Is this important or not?
It's important to the president. This is day number 5 or 6 at this point that the president is continuing to talk about this and try to defend this claim that Alabama was in the crosshairs of the hurricane. He made this claim on Sunday for the first time, even though all of the various forecasts showed that the hurricane had turned northward at that point. And the National Weather Service said that same day that Alabama was in the clear, that it would not see any impacts from the hurricane. The reason it's important is in part because it shows something about the Oval Office, something about how the president operates, that when reality doesn't seem to line itself up with what he's already said, rather than moving on or backing down or, you know, changing course, the president doubles down and he tries to bend reality into his favor. We've seen it with a number of different issues, and this is just the latest example of the president trying to double down on an issue where the facts don't necessarily line up with his point of view, but he takes some of the media criticism personally and wants to prove that he was right all along. And it goes and it turns a potential one-day story into a 5 or 6 day story, as we've seen with this hurricane.
Chad, can you
help? We've had presidents be accused of being the economist in chief or this in chief or that in chief. This is the first time I've ever heard the president being accused of being the cartographer in chief. And with the severity of this storm, a lot of people think that maybe they're putting too fine a point on this, frankly, and it's distracting from other things.
And also that he's spending so much time tweeting about this rather than managing the response in the Bahamas and even along the coast of the United States.
Well, it's just like the comments about Jerome Powell. It's not my fault. It was on that track at one point. That's the problem here. And this is something we see consistently from this administration, that, they can do no wrong or somebody else screwed up or whatever else. I mean, that's just part and parcel of how they roll.
Tolu, why does the president over and over again seem to have so much trouble getting through a natural disaster without controversy?
Well, part of it is that this is a president that likes to make the headlines about himself, and that's sort of not a natural place for these types of natural disasters. Usually you're supposed to be talking about the victims, expressing remorse and condolences to people who are struggling, and really not focusing on, personal grievances. And this is a president that feels much more comfortable talking about his personal grievances, being on the attack against his foil, who he likes to put the media in that position. And natural disasters aren't really made for that kind of behavior and that kind of politicking. So the president hasn't really adjusted to that. And we've seen that with the hurricane in Puerto Rico, the president making that about him and how he felt aggrieved that the Puerto Ricans were not adequately thankful to him, and that the media coverage of his trip to Puerto Rico was skewed against him. So the president likes to make a lot of things about him. And when it comes to natural disasters, most presidents in the past have tried to make it about the victims and tried to make it about the hurricane and the disaster response, not about their personal grievances.
Chad, I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say that you know just about everything that's going on Capitol Hill. So I want to ask you this. Congress is coming back in next week. What's going to happen on guns?
Probably very little. The House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer sent out a memo yesterday. And in terms of, when even something would be on the House schedule, there's nothing there yet, probably until later in the month. They were supposed to have what we call here on Capitol Hill a markup, where they prepare some other secondary and tertiary gun-related legislation, red flag laws. That got called off because of the hurricane, so they haven't completely put all those on the books yet. Keep in mind that the Democrat strategy here is to put pressure on Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. They want to use this as a wedge against McConnell. This plays into the Democrats' narrative that it's a legislative graveyard, their term in the Senate. And how this turns for Democrats politically a little bit is that they could use this as a wedge in Senate races next year in somewhat swing states, Arizona, Texas, Colorado. You have big suburban areas there. Those are western states here where guns have been important in those states, but they have these big suburban voting blocks now, and that could play to the Democrats' advantage. So what you will see and what is different after the shootings is the House will probably advance some gun legislation in the near future, sometime in September, maybe October. The Senate, it's anybody's ballgame. Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, met with the president for a half hour about this yesterday. But it all comes down to the math. You have to get 60 votes in the Senate to get over a filibuster. And Mitch McConnell, he keeps saying, well, I'm not going to touch anything unless the House, Senate, and the president can come to an agreement. That's been McConnell's modus operandi for a long time now. I mean, that schoolhouse rock, he doesn't want just something out there, as a wedge issue. He wants to actually make law if they can come to an agreement, and they're not there yet still.
And totally, I noticed today the calendar is inching closer to September 30th, and there's a funding deadline to keep the government open at the end of the month. Should we expect another shutdown conflict ahead?
Well, it remains to be seen. This is a president that has shown that he's willing to go forward with a government shutdown. We had a very long one, about 5 weeks, actually, earlier this year where the president was trying to get money for the wall. The Democrats did not want to give him money. If that happens again, the president could definitely move forward and say that he's not going to vote for any bill, or he's not going to sign any bill that does not fund his priorities, including on the border. So I wouldn't be surprised if this does lead to another standoff. There may be a decision to kick the can down the road. We've seen the Democrats and Republicans come together in the past on at least having some sort of short-term push to make sure that, you know, the government did not default on its debt. So they have shown that they can come together on major issues before a deadline. We'll have to wait and see whether they decide to cooperate or whether they decide to dig in and have another government shutdown.
And here's the major problem on that. That budget accord that they worked out earlier in the summer, no money in that bill. It sets spending levels. And what you could see with this fight over reprogramming or redirecting money for the border wall from military construction projects is that Democrats and even some Republicans put in strictures in, you know, any interim spending bill to keep the government open and say, hey, you know, we're not going to go for that. That could be a flashpoint between Congress and the White House. And that's why some people don't think that all this has been put to rest as we approach September 30th, the deadline to fund the government.
That is Chad Pergram, senior Capitol Hill producer for Fox News. We've also been speaking with Tolu Olorunupa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Lots going on in Washington. Congress back next week. We'll follow it all. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
October 1st marks 70 years since Mao Zedong, leader of the Communist Party of China, founded the People's Republic of China. Historians have long argued over how to place the legacy of 20th century revolutionaries like Mao in a contemporary context, but our next guest says Mao's influence on global politics was far greater than is typically recognized and that its impact continues today. Julia Lovell is professor of modern China at Birkbeck College, University of London, and is the author of a new book on the topic, Maoism, A Global History. She joins us now from Cambridge in the UK. Professor, first just remind us, who was Mao Zedong the man?
Mao Zedong was born in 1893 in Hunan, South China. In the early 1920s, he became one of the founding members of the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP. By the early 1940s, he had become undisputed leader of the CCP, and he oversaw the party's victory in a huge and destructive civil war between 1945 and 1949. From 1949 to 1976, with the exception of a couple of years when he stepped back from the front line of leadership, Mao was the supreme ruler of China.
But of course, a lot of people know him for the Great Leap Forward, which led to tens of millions of deaths, possibly, in China. How do you put that into Mao's legacy?
Exactly. It's impossible to speak of Mao without mentioning the huge human cost that his political, economic, social, and cultural experiments had, especially for the Chinese people. And sort of foremost amongst those cataclysms was, as you say, the Great Leap Forward, which was Mao's utopian plan for China to reach communism in a handful of years and to overtake the Soviet Union, overtake the United Kingdom, overtake the United States. But tragically, this policy led to a predominantly man-made famine that caused perhaps 30, 40 million unnatural deaths in the early 1960s.
So let's get to the subject of your book then. What is Maoism, the ideology that is associated with Mao as you define it?
It's important to remember that Maoism doesn't mean only one thing. It stands for a wide range of theory and practice attributed to Mao over the past 80 years. So within the context of Chinese communism, Mao was very notable for championing the necessity of violence to achieve the revolution. So a couple of his most famous catchphrases, power comes out of the barrel of a gun and revolution is not a dinner party, really express his validation of political violence. Mao also gave center stage to a non-Western anti-colonial agenda. So he told China and other developing countries that Russian-style communism needed to be adapted to local conditions. He told people that the Soviet Union could go wrong. Again, diverging from Stalin, Mao told revolutionaries to take their struggle out of the cities and to fight guerrilla wars in the countryside. And he also preached something called voluntarism, that as long as they believed they could, the Chinese and any other people could transform their country. So revolutionary zeal, enthusiasm, not weaponry or wealth, was the decisive factor. And the final thing I'd like to draw your attention to, a paradox of these ideas. So like Lenin, like Stalin, Mao was determined to build a militarized one-party state that worshipped its supreme leader, i.e. himself. Mm-hmm. But he also championed a kind of rebelliousness, a kind of anarchic insubordination. So he told the Chinese people that it's right to rebel, cao fan you li in Chinese. And so during the Cultural Revolution after 1966, he used his own autocracy, his own cult, to mobilize millions of Chinese people to rebel against his own party.
So you say that you see evidence of Maoism all over the world and that we're not actually paying enough attention to how far it has spread.
That is one of the arguments of the book, yes. Because after the inception of Maoism in China in the early 1940s, these ideas, these practices spread to practically every continent. So the global impact of Maoism took off in the late 1940s in Asia, in Malaya, Korea, Vietnam, in states mainly on China's borders that were breaking with European and Japanese empires. And Mao's ideas were very important in the first hot conflicts of the Cold War. Traveling to Africa, states and insurgencies in that continent borrowed Mao's ideas and also benefited from lavish Chinese aid programs. Coming closer to home for me, to Europe, the rebellious rhetoric of the Cultural Revolution also inspired the counterculture movement and the protests of 1968 across Western Europe and the US. If we hop over now to Latin America, left-wing politicians there acclaimed Mao's revolution as the path that they should follow in their continent. And there was one individual, a man called Abimael Guzman, who in 1980 launched a Maoist civil war, the Shining Path, against the Peruvian state, which claimed almost 70,000 lives through the 1980s. And then if we come back to Asia at the end, in India and Nepal, Mao's revolution has inspired parties and insurgencies that are still with us today.
Now, the current Chinese president, Xi Jinping, is the son of one of Mao's revolutionary comrades. And while, of course, present-day China is completely different than China in Mao's time, you write that Xi has mounted a selective revival of Maoism. How is he doing that?
So Xi Jinping came to power in 2012, and after taking power, he quite quickly revived parts of the Maoist political repertoire. He's revived something called the mass line, which was one of Mao's big ideas about funneling criticism of officials from the grassroots. And most conspicuously, Xi Jinping has revived the personality cult. And at the end of February 2018, Xi Jinping and his central committee abolished the 1982 constitutional restriction that limited presidents to two consecutive terms in office. So like Mao, Xi could be president for life. But you're also absolutely right that this revival of Maoist political strategies is very much selective. As you say, China is transformed practically beyond recognition from Mao's day. And of course, its citizens are, you know, too well-read, too well-traveled for a sort of single old-style ideological message to persuade them. So, you know, that really was one of the puzzles, the questions that troubled me as I finished writing the book. How will Xi Jinping's very selective revival of Maoist political strategies sit within a China that is so changed from Mao's era?
Why do you think that, given all of what you've told us about how Maoism has extended its tentacles around the world, that it doesn't get the kind of credit that other political movements do today?
You're right. As I began to research the book, I was surprised to learn that there didn't seem to be a history of the global impact of Maoism. And as you say, this contrasts starkly with the quantities of books written about the global influence of, say, Hitler or Stalin. I think there are a couple of reasons for this. One is, I think that the spread and importance of Mao's ideas have been obscured by the end of the Cold War. So especially since the communist collapse in Europe and the Soviet Union, non-specialists have imagined that there's no need to engage seriously with Maoism because it had been rendered irrelevant after the fall of Soviet bloc states in 1989. So that's a kind of Eurocentric explanation, if you like, for the neglect of Maoism as a global force. But the People's Republic of China has also contributed to effacing the global history of Maoism. So for the last 20 years or so, China's rulers have theorized that the country will have a peaceful rise in contrast to the violence of the rise of the West. And history is an important corroborating part of this narrative. Government publicity repeats that China's never interfered in the sovereign affairs of other countries. And under these circumstances, China doesn't want to illuminate its desire for leadership of the world revolution during the Mao era, because this was a time when China exported not just ideology, for example, in the form of the Little Red Book, but also harder currencies of revolution. So money, weapons, and training for global insurgencies, especially in the developing world. And because this history raises so many sensitive political issues for the CCP today, it's hard to research in China. So many key archives and oral histories remain out of reach. So the research for the book was very challenging. It was a truly global undertaking. To write it, I had to access sources in multiple languages from Africa, the Americas, Asia, and Europe.
That is Julia Lovell, who's a professor of modern China at Birkbeck College, University of London in the UK. She's also author of the new book, Maoism, A Global History. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
And let's get the latest on hurricane recovery in the Bahamas. Marvin Dames is Minister of National Security there and a member of Parliament. Mr. Dames, welcome. I know you're incredibly busy. Scores of people are still missing. How are the rescue efforts going today?
As of a day ago, we started flying fixed-wing aircraft onto the island of Abaco. Before that, we had to rely solely on helicopters. And so now that we're able to access a number of the runways on the island of Abaco, we're able to get more people out. So we have the assistance of the U.S. Coast Guard, but we have many locals as well with their own private aircrafts who are flying in. We have a lot of flights moving throughout that airspace, and it's getting pretty hectic up there. We want to make certain that we avoid any mid-air collisions over Abaco.
Yeah. The only international airport on Grand Bahama was destroyed. What's the status of that facility? I know it's very important to have it reopened so that some of these relief supplies can get in and can start getting to people.
Yeah. You know, with Grand Bahama, you know, our concern is primarily the eastern end of the island. And we're able to get a few of our vessels. One should be in port now. As well as assistance from the United Kingdom and the United States, that there's a Coast Guard vessel that is headed there, as well as a British naval vessel that was in Abaco and is now moving toward Grand Bahama. So we're moving in the right direction. There's no doubt about it.
And there's still so much more work to be done. How prepared are you for this death toll to rise significantly?
Well, yeah, up to yesterday, our count was at 30, and we expect that those numbers will continue to rise, especially on the primary settlement of Marsh Harbor. And we have teams searching meticulously, and we're also getting information coming in on missing loved ones, bodies seen on certain parts of the island. We also have the assistance of the Caribbean community, and we have a team of Jamaican Defense Force officers, about 120, that's due in over the next day or so, and from Trinidad. So, as I continue to say, we've never experienced anything like this, Peter, but we're moving forward.
And how are people doing, even if they knew this could happen?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. This is a catastrophe. You have very small communities no longer have a roof over their heads and waiting to receive water and food. And we know that many of these persons certainly would need grief counseling, and we're working on that through our National Emergency Management Agencies. We're getting support locally as well as from abroad, because that in itself, Peter, that will be the challenge moving forward.
Well, our thoughts are with you and with all those people you're trying to help. That's Marvin Dames, Minister of National Security of the Bahamas, also a member of Parliament. Mr. Dames, thank you and best of luck.
Thank you so much, sir.
The average cost of a degree from a four-year private college in the U.S. is $200,000. It's about the same as the median value of a single-family home. And for many parents, paying for college is a sacrifice they're willing to make, even when it takes an enormous toll on their own finances. Caitlin Zaloom is a professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University, and she wanted to understand why parents are sacrificing so much. So she talked to them. Her new book is out this week. It's called Indebted: How Families Make College Work at Any Cost. Caitlin, welcome. You say that parents face several moral traps when they decide whether to pay for their kids' college, and we're going to go through a few of them. But first, why do you see this as a moral issue in the first place?
It's a moral issue because there's a very strong sense of obligation that parents have to raise their children in a certain way. And in the United States, for middle-class parents, that idea is that they want their children to be educated and they want their children to be able to go off in directions that are not hampered by their parents' own situations. College is a really important commitment within that parental value. So parents put a very strong and beyond financial value on what education can give their children.
Okay, so the first moral trap that you point out is this trade-off between paying for what a kid will need when they're little, when they're growing up, and then saving money for college. Describe that.
Parents are asked to save for college in order to ensure this possibility for their child 18 years in the future, at the same time that they're also needing to pay for everyday expenses. And for middle-class parents, that oftentimes has to do with the very kind of readiness they will need to go off to college. For instance, renting or buying a home in a school district where the education is considered to be really good, or whether they should participate in the hockey team, and you maybe have to buy pads or hockey sticks? You know, is it important because your child loves music to buy or rent them a cello? All of that money, which is about trying to establish a life for them that is rich and will eventually reward them not only with the skills of, say, music, sports, and art, but which also deliver the lessons of discipline and a kind of self-reliance that comes with practice that will serve them well in the long run.
Then you write about the second moral trap, this idea of the right college as opposed to the affordable college.
That's right. All parents think about both the finances and the fit. And of course, there are parents who make decisions solely on the finances. But the parents that I spoke with are trying to find a balance between the cost of the colleges they have the choice to send their kid to, and also the possibilities that each one of those places will open distinctively. And more often than not, what I heard from parents was that they preferred to think about fit first before they considered the ultimate finances.
Which means you might end up at a place like Yale or an expensive private school as opposed to the more affordable state school that could be just as good as a fancy college. But that last trap that you described is a wager that college is going to pay off and that it will afford these kids a place in the middle class down the road. From your conversations with parents, did you get the sense that they felt like that wager was worth it?
I think that the parents that I spoke with felt like the wager was worth it for sure, because it was the best way they felt to give their kids a shot. They wanted their children to be able to kind of go out in the world and make themselves into the people that they wanted to be. And college was an important step, maybe the most important step in doing that. It's the moment that children leave their parents' house and decide what direction they are going to take. So they feel like that is worth it to put the money down.
Even if that means they put their own futures at risk.
They worry about that very intensely. At the end of many of my interviews, parents would kind of laugh when I asked them, well, what about your own future? Because the uncertainty they felt was so very great. And of course, we know that there is a savings crisis in this country, and asking parents to put so much money toward their own children's futures is only going to make that worse.
I can't help but think about the college admissions scandal that we've all been following over the last couple of months. I mean, these are very wealthy families that, in fact, can afford to send their kids to college and, in fact, bribe college officials in order to get their kids into these best schools. How does all of that fit into this conversation in your research with middle-class parents who could never do something like that?
That's right. The parents that I spoke with all have to take the student finance system at its face value. They are not able to bribe officials to get their kids in through the quote-unquote side door of the rowing crew. But the value of these scandals, particularly the scandal where the Illinois parents paid lawyers to falsely give their children over to another for custody, is that it showed just how broken the system is. You know, we open up all of these gaps for people who can really spend the time and money and who have the skills to work the system. But for most parents, they have to deal with what they have been given.
That's why I'm wondering if parents who can afford to pay, who, you know, not every parent who can afford to pay is bribing officials to get their kids in. But I wonder if at some point people will say, I can't afford to send my kid to college, but I'm not going to. You know, maybe at some point parents will make the decision to express some rage they have against this system where college is so expensive, and that by paying for your kids to go, it somehow feeds into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that parents are likely to continue to send their kids to college and be quite angry at the same time, because in part because their own experience with college is so very different from what they are experiencing with their children today. So parents who went to school in, you know, the 80s and 90s will not have had to pay nearly as much money as the students today. And that gap oftentimes comes as a big surprise to parents who haven't been planning for it necessarily, but it is also absolutely a huge shock.
How many parents do you think you spoke to over the course of your research?
80 parents, 80 students.
And how many of them are actually having conversations with their kids about this?
You know, they have conversations in a very abstract way, but they don't reveal to their children what the struggles are at home financially.
Why?
Because they feel like their fragility might put their children's futures at risk. They want their children to be able to go off to college without a sense of being responsible for the kinds of choices or predicaments that their parents have found themselves in.
But if the children knew what their parents were facing, couldn't we or shouldn't we trust them to help their parents make the right decision about college?
Well, if we think that the financial decision is always the right decision, that might help. But I think one element that is really important about this silence is that it protects the middle class identity of parents who feel like they are already faltering.
Hmm.
They don't want to allow their kids to know just how kind of imperiled their own status is. And the irony there is that when they pay for college, then they pay the sum they're asked to, it actually ends up then undermining their own stability in the long run, too.
You know, it just makes me think. It makes me think that these parents then are making irrational decisions.
Well, the thing is that we are in a situation where we've forced parents to choose between the values of financial prudence and the values of parenthood. And that is an untenable situation. We shouldn't be surprised that parents are choosing their commitments to their children's futures and educations. We need a way to support that very American commitment.
Caitlin Zaloom, a professor at New York University and the author of a new book that's out this week. It's called Indebted: How Families Make College Work at Any Cost. Caitlin, thank you.
Thank you.
Netflix debuts a new drama today. It's called The Spy, and it's anchored by someone known for his outlandish comedies, Sacha Baron Cohen, creator and star of edgy satires like Borat and TV shows including Who is America? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching and joins us. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Okay, so first of all, how is it?
It's interesting to me because I didn't know much about this story. So basically, Sacha Baron Cohen is playing a figure who's pretty well known to Israelis and pretty well known to people who know Israel's history. But he was born in Egypt. He immigrated to Israel and wound up working for the Mossad, Israel's version of the CIA, to go into Syria undercover, pretending to be a businessman in order to gain intelligence about that country. And this was not too long after Israel had been established. And so there's a lot of tension between Jewish people in Israel and the various peoples that surrounded them. And Sacha Baron Cohen's character was dealing not only with wanting to be patriotic and support Israel, but also feeling that, you know, some Jewish people in Israel looked down on him because they saw him as an Arab. So we've got a clip of him talking to the handler who is trying to suss out whether or not he would be a good candidate for training to actually become an agent. Let's check it out.
If your country needed you to quit your job, would you do it?
To do what?
If your country needed you to quit your job, would you do it?
Yes.
If your country needed you to lie to your friends, your family, your wife, would you do it?
Yes.
If your country asked you to risk your life, would you do it?
I already have.
Now, if you know the history, and this is shown in the very first scenes of the first episode, the real-life person that this was based on, he was discovered in 1965, and he was tortured and executed. And so if you know the history, you know how the story ends. You don't necessarily know how it got there. And that's what the six episodes that are on Netflix are all about.
And that issue of Baron Cohen's character being kind of an outsider in Israel, even though he's Jewish, let's listen to him discussing here how he feels people see him to his wife.
You know what they see when they look at me?
I know what I see.
They see an Arab. That's it. Jewish, yes. But just an Arab.
You're my Arab.
How does the show explore these contradictions?
Well, see, that scene is interesting because it follows a scene where Sacha Baron Cohen's character and his character's wife, they were at a party that was thrown by her employer. And her employer's husband assumed that he was a waiter because he was wearing a vest and he looked like he might be Arab. You know, for me, because I wasn't conversant with these different kinds of tensions, it was interesting to see it play out in a scripted setting. And then there's the tradecraft of actually being a spy. And there's actually a lot of time spent in this series showing him learning how to be a spy. And we even have a clip of him learning his cover story. Let's check it out.
My name is Kamel Amin Thabit. I was named after my father, Amin Thabit. My mother's name is Saida Ibrahim. They were both born in Damascus.
So, yeah. So you see the amount of stuff that he had to memorize and had to become second nature for him to be an effective spy. What the series shows is that he's so eager to prove himself that he's constantly exceeding what they're asking him to do in ways that endangers his cover. It's really interesting. There are some people, I think, who would criticize it. Some of the dialogue is clunky. And I do think that for people who already know this history, it may feel a little simplistic. But for a lot of Americans, this may be their first introduction to this time period in history and these different forces at play. You know, to have a great spy story in the middle of all of this history, I thought it was a really interesting six episodes.
It's interesting to hear Sacha Baron Cohen, who I think of as a comedian, in a dramatic role, especially after watching Escape at Dannemora, produced by Ben Stiller, also a comic actor doing a serious show.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, comics often say, and I agree with them, that comedy is harder than drama, and that a lot of the acting chops that you need to sell something that's comedic, you wind up using when you're in a drama anyway. You know, there's a long legacy of comics being able to tampen down their performances and do quite well in drama. The one thing I think people might say about Sacha Baron Cohen is that he can seem a little stiff at times. I mean, he's trying to play someone who is playing someone. And that is a very difficult performance to try and embody sometimes. And I think sometimes he comes across as a little self-conscious, even for somebody who is a spy in training. But the story is so powerful that it often carries along his performance, even when he isn't necessarily knocking it out of the park as an actor.
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about The Spy, which debuts today on Netflix. Eric, thanks.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.